Welcome, everybody, to the Fantasy Golf Insider Podcast. I'm Jeff Bergerson, joined, as always, by Zachary Turcotte.
How's it going, my friend?
It's going well tonight. Fun week. A course that both you and I like very much, and kind of a blast from the past, Trump National Doral. It's exciting. It kind of kicks off a three-week stretch of exciting stuff. Elevated event, PGA Championship. So three straight weeks. Good time to jump on board. You can, of course, find us at fantasygolfinsider.com for all of your research tools that you possibly need on a weekly basis, from turf splits to rolling stats to building lineups on our lineup generator. You can do it all on our site. It's a very low price, monthly or annual basis. So be sure to join us at fantasygolfinsider.com. Become a premium member. Today, I know you watched quite a bit of last week's event, Zachary, the team at Zurich. Nice story to see the Fitzpatrick brothers come through, get little brother his tour card, which is kind of cool. Yep. What were kind of your takeaways from that?
Yeah, it was fun to see that. I was excited. Obviously, having them on my cash roster was nice. That got me back into the winner's circle after a little bit of a losing stretch there. So I was pleased. I kind of tuned in Sunday just to see them, what I thought would be kind of a cakewalk to the finish. And then the last seven holes, things just about got away from them. I think Matt was really starting to feel the pressure of kind of carrying his, probably felt like he was potentially carrying his brother's livelihood in his hands, and hit a few really, really bad shots, really hard shots. 12, he went way, way right into the trees, created a situation where his brother had a really awkward stance, and then he hit it square right into the tree. I just felt like I was watching one of us take that shot just straight into the tree, bang, back down. I thought, oh, this is going to be an immediate double bogey here, which it was. And then just they couldn't hit good approach shots, some just awful tee shots. It really looked like it was getting into their head. And then all of a sudden it's the last hole and they're tied for the lead with two other teams and they need a birdie. And then Alex, comes up short on the approach into the sand. And then Matt had saved one fantastic shot to end the day and hit it from the sand to about 14 inches. And then Alex tapped in a no pressure putt to get the win. And they shared a hug there, and Alex immediately accepted his invite to the tour. It's cool because we've seen a lot of guys try that over the years. Obviously, it was the fourth try for the Fitzpatrick brothers. Koepka brothers had tried it previously, and you see that with guys who will, you know, pick up an old college teammate or somebody that they've been friends with for a long time, and that's what we're really looking for in that type of an event when we're writing our columns every week. And yeah, it's right in the middle of all these other big signature events and majors. So a lot of times over the years, we've seen some teams that show up every year at the higher level and they play okay, but it's just sort of a throwaway event for them. Whereas these guys, it's something huge on the line because this will completely change Alex's life. In fact, now he's in the field for this week. Right. So it was neat to see that. It was a fun event. It's something kind of unique, something kind of different each year. Like I said last week, I just wish they would position it in the fall right before either the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup and then make it an event where everybody showed up and we got to see, you know, some of the real stars come together and play in a team event like this. I think that would be really cool because it's definitely been one where if you put it at this point in the schedule, it's just not going to draw a lot of players year to year. And it may not even draw like the Fitzpatrick brothers all that much longer. Maybe they'll play it again next year just to defend their title. But, you know, I think it'll be less and less that we see any real names show up for it.
There hasn't been a lot of player of the year talk yet, but it's got to be Matthew Fitzpatrick going away at this point, right?
Big time. Yeah. I mean, it's his third win with just in the last couple of months. And he's just been on an incredible tear going back to about this time last year, you know, going into Augusta and RBC last year. It was terrible. The first 4 months were really forgettable for him. It was awful. It was not even somebody you'd consider playing. And then he really picked up his game towards the end of the summer months and into the fall. It was just great. It felt like he was going to get a win. And then he went over, won the DP World Tour Championship. He's won three times, you know, this year. Lost a heartbreaker in the Players Championship. So he's just been right there. Every part of his game is clicking. And yeah, if he can add another one or two big wins the rest of the way, yeah, he'd be in real good position considering the struggles of, you know, a couple of the other top guys, or just the fact that, you know, guys like Rory, after he, you know, he got his win at the Masters, just hasn't shown up for a few weeks. So yeah, definitely. He's definitely got to be considered the third best player in the world. I think at this point, him and John Rahm are both very close, but until Rahm starts to show us something at majors, I think Matt has probably got to have the edge.
Well, he won't be winning this week because he's not playing this week. He's one of a
bunch of others.
Yeah. A few other names that aren't gonna be playing this week. It's just the way this they've set up the schedule, which is quite awful, with two elevated events leading into a major, makes it really easy for guys to skip. And I'm guessing, like, next week with the Truist, I'm guessing, what is Scotty going to miss that one then, probably?
Yeah, you'll see probably one or two of these guys at the top that will take off.
Morikawa, possibly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Especially dealing, you know, some of the back issues that he's had. I could see like a guy like Fleetwood taking it off, or Cantlay taking it off for sure. Yeah, there'll be a handful of those guys that don't play next week, which is silly because there's definitely, we should never have three non-signature or major events weeks in a row. And there's a couple stretches this season, like right before the Masters, we had, you know, 3 weeks in a row with Valspar, and then we had the two Texas events. You very easily could have slid this event right in the middle there. Had everybody get one more opportunity at a big event and not had that lull in the schedule. But yeah, putting it here, strange, doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's too bad because this is a really great course. This was one of our favorites in our first couple of years. Really fantastic challenge for, as far as golf is concerned, long. Lots of water hazards, lots of bunkers, places where you have to be extremely strategic in terms of your shot placement. And there's, you know, scoring has been around like minus 10, minus 12 range for the winner. So it's kind of the perfect balance, I think, overall for what I would at least be looking for in a golf course.
I love the course, and it's fond of memories for me because it was my first GPP win playing DFS golf back in 2014 when Patrick Reed won it.
Yeah.
And back then, the GPP sizes were nowhere near what they are today. It's hard to even imagine. I think, I don't recall the exact dollar amount, but I want to say it was like $5,000 or less.
Yeah,
and I was winning the biggest GPP on DraftKings that week.
And I was one player off from winning $100,000 in 2015. I had the same first five as the winner, and we had one guy swapped, and his guy ended up beating mine by like 8 or 10 points or something like that to win the whole thing. It was one of our subscribers, actually, but it was still heartbreaking.
And that was in 2015?
It was 2015. It was our first year. Yep, first year on the site.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the course. The last time it was played here was 2016.
Yep.
And since it's been played by LIV, so we have a couple of team events and then a couple of stroke play individual events, so we can kind of look at that. It was redesigned by Gil Hance in 2014, added bunkers, deepened bunkers, added hazards, and lengthened the course to a whopping 7,700 yards.
Yeah, 7,739. It's crazy.
I mean, the Blue Monster is the course, and it is truly a monster. Monster test. The water is really cool. I love that stretch of holes too. It's so fun to watch. The average green size is 7,200 square feet, which ranks it near the top of the PGA Tour. The turf is TIFF Eagle Bermuda, so we can look at that on our putting splits tool. Comp courses, what are you looking at this week, Zachary?
Let's see, what did we end up pulling together? I tried to pull a lot of them together just because it's been so long since we've been here. I tried to look for a handful of different types of courses. So longer courses I looked at, tighter courses, like courses that are down in like the Florida area, down in the southeast. So I looked at Bay Hill. Bay Hill was probably my favorite comp. I had Jackson, Congaree, Eastlake, Innisbrook, PGA National, Quail Hollow, TPC Southwind, and TPC Twin Cities. That was the one course from kind of up in the north that I just sort of threw in just because there's so it's a longer course, tons of water hazards throughout. So I felt like they at least had not quite as easy as TPC Twin Cities, but at least has some of the same sort of risk versus reward setups.
Okay. I put an extra emphasis on driving distance this week. Yes, there is a lot of water and hazards, but as we've seen through the years, it is truly a bomber's course. There isn't much for rough or huge trouble outside of the water hazards. We've seen, you know, pure bombers play really well here through the years. Bubba Watson.
Yes.
Yep. Dustin Bubba. Johnson. Who else? Rory, even Patrick Reed back then when he won it was pretty long off the tee as well. So
yeah, with Justin Rose is a former winner here.
Yep.
So yeah, it's been a lot of bigger names that we've seen over the years. It hasn't necessarily been like, yeah, it's almost always the ones that come to mind are the best of the best.
Certainly. So we're looking at guys who typically do well in majors, because this is kind of a major style course. It's that type of difficulty. I'm looking at low teens for winning score here. I would be surprised if it's above 15 under. Yeah. You never know, I guess, if there's no wind. Speaking of...
Yeah, I don't see too much this week. Yeah, I've been kind of looking at the weather. I don't really see, I don't see the hourlies yet, but not much at all to speak of on Thursday or Friday. Looks like late in the afternoon, the winds get up to about 17 miles an hour Thursday and 15 miles an hour on Friday. That's pretty mellow overall, really calm in the mornings. No cut this week, so I wouldn't really worry about trying to pull together waves or anything like that. But
yeah,
doesn't look like weather is going to be an issue. Not seeing any rain or anything like that in the forecast.
There's not really going to be waves with this small field anyway.
Nope.
So let's look at pricing coming into before the pricing was released. I told you this before. I was like, I think this might be a decent week to go back in on Scotty. I think the course just sets up so beautifully for him. If his price comes down somewhat, I'm happy to move. And then the prices come out. His price did come down a little bit, but when you look at the other options that you have to have when you roster Scotty,
yeah,
you know, in the low 7K range, 7,200, you'd have to average for the rest of your roster.
Right.
I can't see guys in that range. Five guys up toward the top of the leaderboard on a tough course like this, in an event like this.
We've just seen too many weeks in a row now where he's finished in second place and he's been nowhere near a GPP winning lineup.
Correct.
Right. I mean, I suppose if you wanted to, you can drag him out for cash games without a cut this week and then just pair five others with him and hope that you don't have anybody who falls to the bottom and hope that Scotty is up near the top. But yeah, I just think on the GPP side, until we actually see him at a salary like this appear in a winning lineup, I just think we have to ignore him for those contests. He hasn't really even been that close at Augusta or at RBC Heritage.
So. No, and his game isn't completely fixed. His approach game is lacking a lot. When you look at our rolling stats model, you look at the last 12 rounds, the last 16 rounds, he's, you know, almost near the back end of this entire field in strokes gained approach.
Yeah, he struggled there a little bit. He just hasn't quite been able to put together four straight rounds. I have no doubt he'll probably be in contention again.
Probably, yeah.
It's just... yeah, like you said, you look at that low 7K range and you're hoping to find, you know, two or three names right around seven or even just below seven to give you a little boost. And you're just not going to be very excited about the other five guys that you have to play if you end up using Scotty. And so, yeah, I think people will start to get it. His ownership is probably going to come down. And you'd think that price, I think the sweet spot is probably somewhere around like 12, 12, 12, 5, somewhere around there. That would get him low enough so that you could at least start to get into, you know, you maybe one or two low 7K guys, but at least then you'd have at least enough ammo to get yourself up into the 8Ks for some of the other ones. But
yeah, yeah,
13.6
gap can't be so large. The gap between him and like Morikawa shouldn't be close to 4,000.
Yeah, yeah,
it's too wide.
Yeah, it's nuts. Yeah, it's and you just kind of compare their finishes over the last 10, 11 weeks, and you'd have been better off playing Morikawa in every situation except for the, you know, obviously the withdrawal week. But yeah, over the other five starts that Morikawa's had in the same events as Scotty, he's either been ahead of him or right there neck and neck with him. Certainly not $4,000. So Scotty certainly hasn't been $4,000 better in terms of the points he would have gotten you at Augusta or at Harbortown 2 weeks ago.
I know you're liking Morikawa. I like him as well at 9,800. I also like, I think his game sets up well, both Jake Knapp and Chris Goddard up in that low and mid 9K range. I think they're both, you know, long off the tee. Clearly, Goddard up hasn't won a major yet, but I think he will in the near future. So I'm gravitating toward those two guys in the low 9K range.
I think, yeah, both of those guys make a lot of sense. You're looking for guys who are, you know, pretty long off the tee. They're really good as far as their mid to long range approach game. And, you know, we've seen that from Knapp throughout the year. Obviously, he had the little stretch there in Florida where things weren't as good. I think he had the withdrawal at Bay Hill and then missed the cut at the Players. But beyond that, he's been outstanding. Had a really good finish at Augusta, not great at RBC Heritage at Harbortown a couple of weeks back, but yeah, his game has been really good at a lot of these longer courses over the last few years. We've seen him at Torrey Pines a number of times do pretty well there. So yeah, I think Knapp is in play. Goddard is in play, obviously off the tee and on approach.
Yeah,
that's where he excels, and his putter's actually been pretty good of late. And you look at the Turf Splits tool for Goddard up, and he's one of the guys who really shows up well at the top end, much better on pure Bermuda surfaces over any other by over a half a stroke per round. So I love that. I think he's definitely one that should do well here. So yeah, I think for me, Cam Young, we didn't mention him. He's the other player who's above 10-2, obviously coming off of the win at the Players, three other top tens around that. Was in the final pairing there at Augusta and was in the lead for quite a while. So I think his game should be another one that really stands out as far as being solid for this type of course. So Young, Morikawa, Knapp, Goddard up for sure. And I'll probably find at least one other before I get my column put together.
Cantlay's rolling three straight solid finishes, T7 at Copperhead, T12 at Augusta, and T8 at Harbortown. Any interest there?
Maybe. I'm not as excited with the price. Like, I loved that he was down sub 8K and was he 7,900 at the Masters. That was just crazy. I guess we probably aren't going to see that too much more often. I do get a little bit nervous. He tends to be very good at specific courses. And so, like, it wasn't really a surprise to me that he showed up and did well at Harbortown because he's very good there every year. It's just a matter of if he's going to be able to sustain it. I'm not sure. I mean, the numbers definitely look pretty good over his last three starts, but yeah, just getting that price bump and with guys that I definitely like I definitely like Morikawa, definitely like Cam Young. But yeah, I waver a little bit with Cantlay at that price.
Tons of question marks, in my opinion, in that 8K range. Probably the most, the guy I had the most confidence in would be Justin Rose, but like we were saying.
Yeah, I know.
Club change, right? Probably information that we'd rather not even have this week, right?
Yeah, if we would have ignored that, you could have just made him a core play and just moved on. You know, obviously third place at Augusta, dominant win at Torrey Pines, where he's won a couple of times. So, you know, clearly longer courses are places where he's had success. He's a former winner here back in 2012. Plenty of experience on the course, which is great. But yeah, he did this. I don't know if you guys will all remember, but I'm sure many of you will, back in like the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, where he switched over to these Japanese clubs, Hanma, I think they were called. And at the time he was, you know, his game was peaking. He was kind of nearly the number one player in the world and everything was going his way. And he still, he won at Torrey Pines that year, if I remember, after he had just switched. But then it kind of turned into a disaster after that. And after about a year, he dropped it, which, I mean, that's pretty bad. I'm sure they probably had like a 5 or 10 year deal or something crazy. So to part ways after 1 year, and I don't think I've heard of anybody using Hanma clubs since then. So yeah, so now he's using McLaren clubs, which, I mean, that's I guess if you've known them from their racing days, that's exciting. But I don't
get it. Money can't be the deciding factor. Can it? I mean, for Rose, how much money does the guy need?
And he's always used a mixed bag before clubs, from what I was reading. It's just, I don't know. You'd think that'd be like the one thing you wouldn't really want to screw around with, especially right. when you're going good. Your game is
yep.
pretty good and you're near the end of your career. Like, I don't know. That does freak me out, just because we've seen what's happened before with him and with other guys. Takes some adjustment time for some of these guys to kind of figure things out and to get comfortable. And I'm sure he's been practicing with them for a while, but yeah, I don't know. Just little changes like that. That definitely always makes me a little bit nervous. So I do like Maverick McNealy this week. I think 8,800 is a good price for him. He hasn't quite been in contention this year, but he hasn't been that far off. So lots of top 25s, lots of top 20s this season. I think his game is starting to get close. This should be a pretty good spot for Minwoo Lee. He was having a great season coming into Augusta before everything just kind of fell apart for him. But somebody who's been very good, tee to green for most of the season, usually very good. He's pretty good distance.
Yeah, long.
Off the tee, pretty good distance as far as his iron play is concerned. But yeah, the last couple efforts have not been great, so I'm not certain if that moment has passed or not, but he played pretty well in the couple of events that he was in down here in Florida. He had a sixth place finish at Bay Hill. So I think he's somebody at least worth considering there. And then Adam Scott is one that I think a lot of people will probably gravitate towards. He was the last winner here on the PGA to win in 2016. A handful of other top 10 finishes here. That was kind of back in his heyday, when his irons were among the best on tour, and he's been pretty good so far this season. I know you've talked a couple of times on the podcast and in your columns that he's playing a little bit more this year. He's not taking quite as much time off, which I think we both like. And one of the things that I do like is that his irons have been outstanding this year. So that was kind of what made him a really elite player at that time. He won a couple times. If I remember, I feel like he won at Riviera and then he won at this event. He won like back-to-back events, something like that, back in 2016. But he was just on fire at that point. But the irons are back, so I am encouraged there. Maybe he doesn't contend, but 8,400, that's still a pretty fair price for a guy who's definitely got top 20 upside. So I think he's definitely one that will make my player list. Any of these other three or four in the 8K that you're looking at?
Not so much. I mean, Harris English, maybe. I find myself more in that 9K range, and that forces me back down to the 7K range. So I don't have a ton of exposure to that 8K range. 7K yeah. range is interesting. I would think it's a good course for Gary Woodland. I like where his game has been. I still don't. There's something about it that I don't have complete and utter trust in him. Even though after following his victory in Houston, he has been good. T33 at the Masters, a T8 at Harbortown, which I wouldn't even say would be
not his type,
an ideal course for him, but I think Doral certainly is. So I'll loan him 7,400, and then I'll go to Pearson Cootie because I've been holding off to make sure that back was okay, because I just was shocked that he withdrew in the middle of an event in Texas that he absolutely needed to do well in, to get into the Masters, and he withdrew. So it had to be serious, but then he looked good at Harbortown 2 weeks ago. So maybe that back's good. And if that's the case, if he's 100%, I think this is a good course for him, who's, you know, he's long off the tee. We saw what he can do early in the season. I'm not sure. Maybe the struggles were back related. He missed a couple of cuts there in a row, including Bay Hill and TPC Sawgrass. Maybe that was the back being an issue. I don't know, but I'll take a stab with him in some GPPs.
How about a guy like Kurt Kitayama at 7,900? He hasn't played here before. Obviously, he's kind of an up and down player. He could be a little bit all over the place. He had a second place finish earlier this season at Riviera. He's a former winner at both Bay Hill, and then last year he won at TPC Twin Cities up here in Minnesota. So he's had some success on some of these longer courses that. That do have a fair amount of water hazards around them. So I don't know. He was one that kind of intrigued me there a little bit. And he had an eighth place finish a couple of weeks ago at Harbortown. So definitely not a guy who's always week to week consistent, but
no.
Just saw a couple things there that kind of caught my eye as far as somebody to watch in that range.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't hate it looking at, he was good at Riviera. That was the runner-up finish, right? Good at Bay Hill.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't hate that play at all. I've been waiting for Ben Griffin to round into form, and we've seen kind of middling, T30 type performances. So I'm not loving him.
Yeah. The price is starting to come down, but he had a terrible stretch in Florida this year. He wasn't good at all down there, which is weird because his putting splits on Bermuda are actually pretty good. He did look pretty good with Novak last week. They had a 10th place finish as a team. So maybe that's something that he can use as a bit of a launching point for him. But yeah, it's mostly been a kind of a disappointment for him. And at a longer course like this, it doesn't necessarily a spot that I would think would suit his game in particular. Sepp Straka is intriguing a little bit there at 7,900. He had a 42nd place finish at Harbortown 2 weeks ago, but really he was right there, kind of near the top, all the way up until the last round, and then just completely fell apart. So he shoots 66, 67, 67, 78 in the final round. So he went from being like a top 10 guy and having a pretty good week there to, falling just about off the leaderboard. He had a pretty good run in Florida, 13th place finish at Bay Hill, 8th at the Players Championship. Obviously, he's had some success there in the past with wins. I believe he's won previously at, I think he won at PGA National, but he's been pretty good at Florida courses over the years there. And so without seeing any course history and then just recent results not being what we've come to expect, I think he's somebody who could jump up for his price. I think he's a pretty fair value.
Dropping down a little bit more, we're getting into a range that becomes a little more difficult, and that's why it makes it very difficult to own Scotty this week, because this is where you'd have to live if you own Scotty.
Yeah.
What down in this range intrigues you?
There's a handful that do jump out a little bit. Can Shane Lowry turn things around?
Oh, I don't know.
It's been rough to watch since he choked away at PGA National, that would almost a for sure win there. He had the miscut at Bay Hill, miscut at the Players.
He's not been the same.
He was cruising even at Augusta. Things were starting to look good for him up until the final, where he shoot an 80 in the final round. So that was a disaster. Him and Brooks teamed up and missed the cut on the numbers. So they missed by one shot.
That was a weird team to begin with, but
yeah,
that's shocking that they can't even get through the cut.
Yeah, a little bit of a surprise there. But he's had Lowry over the years. He's had success on longer, tougher types of courses. We know he's got the skill set to do it. It's just a matter of whether or not he can get out of his head for long enough to do it. So I think the talent is there for him. I'm just and I will own him this week because $7,600 I think is a great price. I will probably own a little bit of Keith Mitchell just as far as looking at guys who are really strong with their ball striking. And look at Mitchell's comp course numbers actually look pretty good. 41 career starts. He's gained 0.73 strokes per round. We look at the Bermuda setup. He's a decent Bermuda putter over the years. And then just as far as looking at his strokes gain numbers, he ranks 14th among this field in strokes gained tee to green over the last 16 rounds. Obviously a guy who's been tremendous off the tee throughout his career, sort of similar type of player as what Gary Woodland would be. So I think he is another one that I would take some shots with. Pearson Cootie, you mentioned him before, up and down year, had a great year all the way up into that Florida stretch and then was kind of miserable there. So I'm a little bit nervous, but bounced back nicely 2 weeks ago with the 16th place finish at Harbor Towns. That was encouraging there. I guess he's another one of those players where you're looking for guys who are really good, long off the tee. So he's one of the few who I think down here in this range actually sizes up pretty well for this length of course. So I think he's one that I would keep an eye on. Maybe a little bit of Sam Stevens there at $7,300. And yeah, the rest of this list gets tough. Berger is somebody who historically I think I would have played in this field, but yeah, the last few outings, not great. You know, he had a nice little run there. What was the event where he ended up finishing? What was he second at? Was that at which event did he end up finishing second at? I can't remember which one that was there, but he had one pretty good finish and then things kind of fell apart for him. I think that was actually at Arnold Palmer.
Bay Hill, yeah.
Yeah, Bay Hill. So he was second at Bay Hill, but then the next week he's 66th at the Players. He missed the cut at Augusta, which not terribly shocking, and then 42nd at Harbor Town. So, you know, since that second place finish at Bay Hill, it hasn't been that pretty the last few starts. Numbers wise, historically, he would be somebody that I would look at here. So I think he's probably somebody that I'll own, but yeah, just not sure where he'll end up being this week. Rio at 7,000, I'll probably take a shot with, and then Sudarshan. He did play pretty well in Florida, so he's another one that I do like, although I'm happy to see his price come down. I don't like paying up for guys like that who have a few great events and then all of a sudden they're like 8,500 or whatever he was, like 9,500 last week in the team event. So back down there at 700, I don't mind having a few shares. Anybody else that you like in the sixes?
Yeah, I know this will burn me, but Ryan Fox makes a ton of sense to me this week. He's had some decent finishes at my comp courses this year, long off the tee even at his age. I just think this is a really good spot for him, but he has burned me more than a few occasions. So that I say that with a little hesitation. Who else? Bud Cauley, $6,600. I will own a few shares of him. And another guy who's intriguing to me who stood out on my comp course model is Max Homa. Don't know that he can be trusted, for consistency wise. But even when you look at like this year, a couple of his better finishes have been on comp courses, even like Augusta T9. When you look throughout his career, he's had success on comp courses. So, you know, you're just looking for any small caveat that will stand out for any of these 6K guys. And he's a guy who I am willing to take a shot on here.
Yeah, you could probably throw some Andrew Novak out there. He's been better.
He's starting to play better. Yep.
He was really pretty good last season. And then had just a terrible start to 2026, but now three top 20s in his last four, 10th place with the team event this past week with Ben Griffin. But he's got pretty good distance off the tee, 6,500, you know, it's a throwaway price there, but type of salary there that frees up quite a bit of space up top. So yeah, he's probably the other one that at least marginally caught my eye down here on this low end.
I don't have much else for this event. I mean, for a small field, no cut, I think we covered a lot. Any highlights from the NFL draft that's happened since we last spoke?
As a Viking fan, I was irritated yet again. It's painful as a fan to watch this happen. I was happy to see Kwesi get fired. So I thought he was historically just terrible as a GM, awful from the get-go. Drafts were just awful under him. He missed just about in every way imaginable, put the team in such a terrible salary cap position that they'll spend all of this year and part of next probably just digging their way out. You know, but then they didn't hire, they ran the draft with an interim GM, which I didn't like, because that doesn't really put nobody's really on the hook for this draft then. So they go out and they, you know, in the first round, they draft a defensive lineman who is a stud, except for the fact that he has a history of foot injuries. So he's had pretty bad foot injuries a couple different times, all the way into, you know, pre-draft workouts this year. He's still dealing with, you know, the aftermath of a broken foot, which is not great for a big defensive tackle who's already dealing with that type of a problem. So that's a huge risk coming out of the gates. And then for your GM, who may or may not even have to be the guy who has to own up for that type of pick if it doesn't work out. So that's strange. I thought that was a very risky pick to start the draft. And then we had heard before the draft that there were chances that Jonathan Grenard might get traded. And I guess in my mind, if you've got like an edge player who's as elite as a guy like Grenard is, you want to make sure you at least get, I don't know, a second round pick, maybe a first round pick. I mean, back when the Vikings traded away Stephon Diggs, they got a first rounder for Diggs, which I, you know, think that was pretty reasonable. But the Vikings take the Eagles comp pick for this year, which is like number 98, and then they get a third rounder for the Eagles next year, which, looking at the Eagles roster, will probably be around like 98 again, somewhere in the 90s, as far as that pick goes, depending on how far the Eagles go in the playoffs. For a guy who's a Pro Bowl caliber edge rusher, great run defender. I mean, he's probably their best defensive player. I mean, he only had a few sacks last year. He had some injuries, and but he's just been an amazing all around player. And you get two late third round picks for him, I mean, that just seems like they got fleeced. I wasn't happy with that at all. He still had 2 years left on his deal. I would have probably just played hardball with him. Said, hey, you're coming off of an injury. We'll see what you can do. If you play pretty well this season, we'll give you a bigger extension. But hey, we still got 2 years left. I mean, he's going to be 29 this year. I just think they let him off the hook a little too easily. Even if he was going to hold out, I just said, fine, you got 2 years left on your deal, man. You got hurt near the end of last season with a shoulder injury. We're not going to give you $100 million for 4 years. I think the Eagles probably overpaid a little bit, but still, I think the Vikes let them get away for just about nothing. And if you look at the history of Viking third round draft picks, they've missed just about every year forever. I mean, I don't know who the last one was that's even reasonable. I think I looked it up. It was like the best third round pick the Vikes have had in like the last 7 or 8 years was Alexander Mattison back in 2019, who was, yeah, I mean, he made some contributions here and there. He wasn't elite, but he contributed a little bit. But that's it. The rest of the other like 7 or 8 that they've had have been complete busts. So that was, that was a little disappointing. Took a big risk in the first round, traded away their best defensive player. I mean, they have some, that does open up some salary cap space, because like I said, it was a nightmare with what Kwesi did before. But it seems like the team is, and hopefully maybe they'll actually hit on a draft, but they've missed so much over the last few years. I guess I don't feel super confident. So that was my Viking analysis. Other things that
One thing I wanted to ask you about, and I don't watch nearly as much college football as I used to. I obviously watch a lot of professional football because we cover it for the site.
Yep.
But the Rams.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
mention.
Ty Simpson seemed bizarre to me.
Seemed like a big reach to go up, and because he was certainly not projected to go anywhere near 13.
No.
There, all the way into the draft, it was like the question was if he'd even go in the first round. And so I can't for the life of me. And then the other thing is like for the Rams to feel like the Rams are in win now, like this probably is Stafford's last season with them. Why not go get him one more piece on defense or offense that he can use immediately?
Yeah. Especially, and next year's quarterback class looks good too. So
much better than this year. This year was garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, as you know, outside of Mendoza, he was really the only sure thing. I don't know that there will be another guy who ends up starting. Like, I mean, watching Ty Simpson, I was not blown away at all. I mean, he's around. He's in Alabama, so it's always hard to grade guys down in Alabama, anyways. Because right. you're playing with so many other really good players around you that it's hard to see what he's capable of. In my last major memory of the guy is him getting absolutely curb stomped against Indiana in the Rose Bowl, which, you know, was about the most embarrassing thing ever for Alabama. I don't know why they were so desperate there when there's so many guys they could have drafted around them, around that spot there that could have helped push that team over the top. I mean, yeah, he'll have a year with Stafford to learn the ropes, I guess. Maybe they really do think he's the guy. And if he is great, then it'll look great. But in a win now situation in a division as tough as what they have, I mean, you got to knock off the defending Super Bowl champs. The Niners will certainly be back in contention again. I guess I probably would have looked for a piece that would have been able to help contribute immediately. I don't know. I guess I didn't see too much else in the draft that caught my eye too much. It was interesting to see like the number of tight ends that position has taken off. It was just like as soon as somebody took a tight end, that like there ended up being like eight or nine of them like got picked in the early rounds. And
What team picked one who had? Oh, the Jets. Yeah, the Jets, and they have Mason Taylor. So I was kind of surprised that they took a guy. Didn't they take a tight end?
The teams in these days are just loading up on them now. Like it's not strange to see teams have like two or three guys that they can trot out on a pretty regular basis. They just use them in so many more situations as far as blocking and in catching the ball. So yeah, it's interesting to see that the way that has changed. It was a unique draft. There were a lot more skill position guys that went right away early. So we had a bunch of wide receivers off the board, you know, running back off the board pretty early. I didn't like that. I guess like, you know, I realize teams have this philosophy of you take the best guy who's available at the time. And okay, that's fine. So the Cardinals go out and they draft Love out of Notre Dame, and they make their offense that much more fantasy fun
to watch. Right.
So they'll be fun. That'll be another team that you can load up on in the late afternoon window all year, because they're going to be in a lot of 40 to 35 kind of games next year. But
I think a lot of balls out of the backfield coming from behind, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it kind of hurts you a little bit on the pass catching side, you know, because they'll probably have the running back contributing a little bit more. But I think decisions like that are really silly. I know teams think, oh, this guy's a generational talent, but the Cardinals are nowhere near being a team that's going to be worth a damn. They're not going to be a playoff team this year or next year, probably the year after that. You know, they got Brissett there as quarterback this year. How long is he going to be their starting quarterback? So they don't have their future quarterback anywhere around there. They don't have anything to deal with on defense.
And how many Super Bowl champs over the past couple of decades have had elite running backs?
It's very, very few. Yeah. It's very, 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 very few. Yeah, we looked at it one year. It's crazy. It's like there's like one or two over the last 20 years that you look at that are marquee names. And then you go draft one right here. And then the problem is he's going to put up good fantasy numbers. So then by like 3 years in, he's going to be up for a big contract. But your team, it will not be in contention yet. So then you'll end up paying another skill position player a whole bunch of money and you won't have the team around him that you'll need to kind of get through. So I hate when teams, especially teams like the Cardinals, do that. You can do that if you're a team that's right on the cusp and you need another running back or another skill position player to put your team over the top, then yeah, I have at it. But when it's like the Falcons, they've got Bijan there and that's fine, but he's going to get paid a huge contract in a couple of years. And the Falcons are a shit team, you know,
and they only got a few years left in them. I mean, they hit the wall, most of them at 27.
Yeah. It's just really rare that they hit it just right. I mean, the Lions hit it with Jahmyr Gibbs because their whole team was kind of peaking at the right time. So that worked out for them. But yeah, other than that, I never liked those types of moves for those sorts of teams in the early spots of the draft. There's just so many other things that you have to build first before you go to the explosive types of players. I wasn't watching super closely, I guess, outside of that. There wasn't a whole lot that startled me in the early round. Yeah, like I said, the Ty Simpson one was funny, and then you're watching McVay look a little irritable in the press conference. You could tell that certainly wasn't the pick he was necessarily looking for them to make. But yeah, no, I guess I don't have a whole lot else on it.
Let's get out of here, Zachary. We'll leave it at that. Best of luck. We got Doral this week. We got the Truist next week, which is Quail Hollow, which is another great course that I really enjoy. And then the PGA Championship the following week. So great stretch of golf here. Should be exciting. Hopefully we can take home some big GPPs, keep winning the cash games. And if you have any questions, be sure to check us out. You can jump in the Slack chat or send us any questions and we'll happily get back to you. So best of luck this week, and we'll be talking to you next week.
Good luck.